You're listening to Decoding Healthcare Innovation with Carrie Nixon and Rebecca Gwilt, a podcast for novel and disruptive healthcare business leaders seeking to transform how we receive and experience healthcare.
Welcome back to Decoding Healthcare Innovation. Today, both Carrie Nixon and I are hosting the pod. Hey, Carrie.
Hey, Rebecca. We haven't done this in quite a while together. I'm excited.
Yes. Yeah, I'm super excited. I know this is a topic we've both been thinking about for a while. For those of you who may have forgotten, Carrie and I are the co-founders of Nixon Gwilt Law, where we help digital health companies navigate law and policy to build great businesses. Today, I'm delighted to share the pod with Luis Argueso, partner at InHealth Advisors, self-described expert in value-based care and new dad. Welcome to the pod, Luis.
Thank you for having me, Carrie and Rebecca.
Yeah, so Luis and I met at a lawyer's conference. If you attended one, you know it's not exactly, you know, BravoCon. Very serious topics for very serious people, but Luis did a really creative spin on his presentation, rooted in ancient Rome, maybe Latin phrases. What was that, Luis?
I tried to make the content a little fresh, like you said. When you have a room full of attorneys, oftentimes the temptation is to get straight to the law and the details, and just wanted people not to doze off, especially since it's a topic that can have a lot of nuance, especially when it comes to the regulations and getting into the details of what's required there.
Yeah. So I, you know, even if I wasn't interested in the topic, it was a very creative spin. It kept me rooted and excited to jump into it today. We'll probably go less deep than we did on the legalities there, because I really want to talk about sort of how this is happening in the real world. What I gathered from the presentation was that Luis has been thinking through something Carrie and I have been thinking through for a few years since they were introduced, and that is the newish concepts of the value-based enterprises. In particular, I want to explore today what they are, how companies can leverage them to create some flexibilities in their business model and still avoid the, you know, scary, stark, and anti-kickback implications. So I'm excited to jump right into it. You ready?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right. So can you, in completely non-legal layman's terms, just give us a high-level understanding of what a value-based enterprise is? And we're gonna call this a VBE for short, but what is a value-based enterprise?
Yeah, absolutely. So a value-based enterprise, or VBE, it's essentially a regulatory construct. So a business, although the requirements to create it aren't necessarily as formal as forming a business, but it's a construct that permits substantial freedom in how a healthcare organization can pay providers for healthcare services. And that freedom is gained in exchange for adhering to certain requirements around the relationship between the parties and how the providers of healthcare services are participating in value-based care initiatives. So doing things like improving quality for patients or controlling the cost of healthcare. So in exchange for participating in those initiatives, you get a little more freedom in terms of how you can pay providers. And this comes within the framework of the Stark Law and anti-kickback statute that govern all sort of payment relationships between healthcare entities.
And Luis, the Stark and anti-kickback statutes are really kind of the bane of lawyers' existence and maybe non-lawyers alike, right? Because they impose some significant constraints on the types of arrangements that healthcare providers and entities that facilitate healthcare and healthcare payers can enter into. And, you know, even to the point of really kind of stifling new and innovative ways of providing care and paying for care. So, you know, the anti-kickback statute and Stark, I believe, were really created in a construct around a fee-for-service model. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me, like, as we've shifted and as we're trying to shift to value-based care, you know, these new safe harbors are an effort to sort of free up to some of those constraints and to you know, allow for some new and innovative types of arrangements and business relationships that, frankly, are typically allowed in any other sort of industry, commercial industry, but are typically prohibited in healthcare. Is that sort of in keeping with how you are viewing these?
Yes, absolutely. So my background is in economics, and it's all about incentives. So in the fee-for-service world, the incentive is to do more. And of course, if your incentive is to do more, is to go to payers and say that you've done a large number of services to get paid more, well, there's always then bad actors, a small percentage of the bad apples out there that are going to try to take advantage of that system. And so the Stark and anti-kickback statute are essentially the protection that the government has tried to build into the fee-for-service world to make sure that entities aren't engaging in fraud, waste, and abuse. What's neat about value-based care, and something that the government recognized with these value-based enterprises, is that if you do them right, that is, if you build the structure for compensating folks for delivering good value-based care correctly, a lot of the concerns that were associated with fraud, waste, and abuse around fee-for-service medicine go away. And so the value-based enterprise construct was designed to say, all right, let's take those bits and pieces of value-based care that essentially have inbuilt protections in them. Let's make them requirements of these value-based enterprises. And let's say that if you do that, then we no longer hold you to a lot of the very high and complex standards that are associated with the Stark and anti-kickback statute, like, demonstrating fair market value, like demonstrating commercial reasonableness, like prohibiting any sort of payment based on the volume or value of referrals, which, as you mentioned, are things that in any other context or any other industry are just norms.
And you mentioned that this was, that this is particularly applicable for healthcare systems that want to pay their providers in a more sort of creative way to, align incentives. Have you seen any other applications of this other than sort of getting around physician comp?
Most of it focuses on physician payment. And I would add to kind of that description the idea around, all right, let's say we have an existing relationship with a provider. I'm a healthcare organization. Now, and noting that the status of healthcare organizations nowadays, especially large systems, difficult financial times for them. They're having a lot of cost pressure. At the same time, physician practices are seeing a lot of that as well, but your payers are may not necessarily be sort of in the same boat. And so you have health systems and their affiliated providers get together and say, look, we think that we can do better for our patients while at the same time controlling the cost of care, but that's going to take a lot of effort on our part. And we want to make sure that doing that is something that we can receive, is activity from which we can receive financial reward. So I think a lot of the conversation around these value-based enterprises is finding ways to say, all right, we know it's going to take some upfront lift for us to develop a value-based care program, but we know that by doing so, we can demonstrate consistent benefits to patients in terms of the quality they receive and benefits to payers in terms of controlling the costs. So it's really a negotiating tool that those two parties can use and then take to payers to say, look, we've already demonstrated through this value-based enterprise that we have a framework in place that holds our providers accountable. We can, match this framework to a lot of the same sort of initiatives that payers are targeting. Their payers are evaluated based on their HEDIS measures. A lot of those measures carry over into things like MIPS measures that physicians are held accountable to through Medicare. So a lot of the existing infrastructure is there in these organizations. It's tracked. It's a matter of pulling in all the different bits and pieces together to create something that's more formal so that you can really start to do things like generate shared savings and share in the financial benefit through those shared savings between those organizations and providers.
Yeah. So, Luis, I think you and I share the belief that these VBE arrangements can provide a real opportunity for digital health companies who usually, frankly, are not really allowed to be directly involved in the mix, right, with getting reimbursed for care, right? They can provide a service and get a fee for it, but they're not really involved in sort of moving the needle on costs and care directly. Talk a little bit about your views on how these VBE safe harbors and VBE arrangements might really benefit digital health companies and the healthcare providers that they work with.
It's a great question and one that I have a lot of thoughts on. In a prior life, I did a lot of work with digital health companies, getting into the nitty-gritty of their business plans, and in particular, helping them navigate the rules around corporate practice of medicine. and finding payment streams between the professional corporation and the telemedicine entity itself. I won't dive into the details there. That's something that Rebecca covered very well in her presentation at the conference we were at. But nonetheless, in doing that, I discovered a lot of things that I think make value-based enterprises very well suited to digital health companies. The first thing that I'd say, and the biggest and most important thing, is a lot of digital health companies come from the tech world. They're kind of a splicing of the tech and healthcare industries. And the tech world is all about subscription-based revenue. So revenue streams that are derived by taking a fixed revenue number per customer, however you might envision it, and finding a way to generate a scalable business off of that fixed revenue stream. And quite fortunately for digital health companies, within the context of healthcare, that idea of a subscription fee revenue is basically essentially what capitation is. Capitated reimbursement effectively is taking either all the care that's provided to a patient or some subset of that care and turning it into a regular per patient per month payment. And many of the telemedicine businesses that I worked with, either they directly had contracts with payers that were capitated, they were reimbursed on a per patient per month basis for the services that were provided, or for the purposes of budgeting, they basically, looked at the revenue streams on a per patient per month basis. So why is this important in the context of value-based care? Well, capitation is one of the payment based on a capitated model is one of the explicitly contemplated types of payment systems within the value-based enterprise exception that enable an organization to meet the exception. And that oftentimes is a big headache for a lot of healthcare provider organizations, because for decades, they've been used to the fee-for-service world where they're looking at trying to find and maximize the amount of codes that they can bill for a service. Well, that's flipped when it comes to digital health companies working within a capitated framework. So already from the revenue that they take in, from the basis of how they're generating revenue to be a sustainable business, they have a leg up on other businesses because they're working within that capitated framework. So that's kind of prong one. Prong two then is participating within value-based care is heavily driven by quality metrics. And a lot of the benefits that come with being a tech-oriented business can carry over into that quality accountability type world. So a lot of these digital health companies already have in place platforms that are capturing a lot of the data that feed into determining the quality of care that their service is delivering. So they already have the tech infrastructure that's needed to make value-based care a success for their organizations. And so they're able to capture a lot of the information that either a payer wants to see or their partner healthcare organizations want to see in order to determine whether or not the quality of care that's being delivered is there or isn't there. And kind of a sub-prong to that, coming from the tech world as well, is there's a lot of focus within digital health on consumer experience. So I did a lot of work with direct-to-consumer companies, and they did a great job in terms of having a website or platform that were very user-friendly. And these are things that also carry over well into value-based care, whether you're talking about measuring patient satisfaction scores, things of that nature. So from those two prongs, I would say digital health, unlike many other healthcare organizations out there, are really built on the foundation of looking at things on a capitated basis and working with data analytics that can easily be flipped into some sort of quality program that can be tracked and compensation can be tied to it.
Right. And in the end, right, these digital health companies can actually end up making more revenue than they otherwise would have if they were just providing the services fee on a per patient per month fee for service basis, right? So my presumption is once you have the data to know that your intervention, let's say it's a remote patient monitoring company, right? That's monitoring for hypertension. Once they've really nailed, care management for hypertensive patients and how to move the needle on costs and outcomes, they can do that on a fee-for-service basis, sure, but if they go into a value-based arrangement, they actually then have the opportunity to go at risk and to even earn a little bit more. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So the first thing I'd say is from the payer perspective, if you look at all these value-based programs and capitated programs, the starting point is always, where are we at now today with fee-for-service? And So that's looking at what's the cost per patient using, you know, the existing utilization. Well, because of the incentives built into the fee-for-service model, there is kind of inbuilt into it some waste that can be addressed by these digital health companies in bringing their tool or service to the patient. And so really, you know, the at least the digital health companies that I've worked with, and I'm sure the ones that you worked with, they're built along the concept of scalability. And that's something that is an excellent concept to apply to when you're working within a capitated reimbursement framework, because you can say, hey, look, historically, these patients have been costing you $100 per patient per month. We're going to come in and contract with you on a $90 per patient per month basis. And if we're able to save $10 per patient per and we're able to consistently save $10 without diminishing quality, let's you and I share, you know, $5 of that revenue nut. Well, as that business grows and as the number of covered lives within the organization increases, then the business is able to leverage their scale. And, you know, now all of a sudden we have a little more of a revenue base that we can use to fund maybe enhancements to our care platform that further increase our ability to reduce costs. Say, for example, by splicing in predictive analytics that allow us to identify like the really high risk patients that might be at risk for, say, things like costly events like readmissions and ED utilization and things like that. So it's one of those things where you can start, like you said, at a better revenue position and even leverage it further as the organization scales upwards.
So we mentioned briefly that a value-based enterprise requires value-based participants, right? Quote unquote, value-based participants. And that includes a payer who is, you know, somehow sort of at risk, right? Which most are in general, but, you know, in some sort of risk-bearing relationship. And it also requires providers, of course, and then it can include things like digital health companies or vendor companies that are participating as well. Those are, it can be hard to get those participants, like sort of those that, you know, participants coming from different angles to align around what an arrangement looks like or should look like. How do you think about that? How do you, first of all, sort of get those participants together, and then how do you get them aligned on what they're trying to do?
Yeah, it's a great question. One of the things that I did in the presentation that Rebecca mentioned off the top is kind of talk about the state of the healthcare industry and highlight a couple of statistics. One of the big ones that really stood out to me is, I think if you look at surveys nowadays, over half of providers are reporting that they have a lot of burnout. And on top of that, you're looking at healthcare organizations and their profit margins, and things are kind of, especially nowadays, are very challenged. So I think the place to start the conversation is, what problems can this value-based enterprise solve for us to motivate us to sit down together at the table to come up with a business plan that's mutually beneficial for everyone? And, you know, you can come at it from a couple of different angles. The loss aversion angle that I come at it with is, if you're having difficulty getting providers to have a seat at the table, the first thing I'd say to them is, look, payers are figuring out how to succeed in value-based care. They, you know, if you look at whether it's an organization like Optum, or now, you know, you had the Kaiser's kind of joint venture with Geisinger, organizations are figuring out how to meld the insurance and provider side of things to really benefit from things like shared savings. On top of the payers, though, you even have health systems that are more and more entering into these value-based contracts. You can look at some of the Medicare's innovation models. So you, provider group, don't want to be the last person at the table when it comes time to figuring out how to kind of divvy up the benefits of providing high-value care, especially since you, provider, are oftentimes the person most directly involved in achieving those outcomes. So I think a lot of it is a getting seats at the table exercise, and then it's a change management exercise. It's a exercise of saying, how do we see this as an opportunity for us, insurer, health system, payer, to work together? Because oftentimes there can be a tendency to view each other as adversaries. The promise of value-based enterprises is that they really reward the organizations that are able to get together and work as a team. Now, the nice thing about value-based enterprises that the government recognized is that that's not going to happen overnight. And so they have built into the exceptions some of those, some transitional exceptions, where, for example, the anti-kickback statute has what's called a care coordination exception, where revenue doesn't necessarily have to be at risk, but a healthcare system can do something like contribute infrastructure to a provider group that is going to enable them to participate in value-based care. So it can do things like contribute care coordinators or health infrastructure, health information technology infrastructure to help the practice get in place the systems and processes that are needed to succeed. And it can do that at a discounted rate. Under that exception, the provider group is only responsible for paying at least 15% of the cost of those contributed in-kind forms of remuneration. So I think that's a big way that you can get folks at the table together, is to say, look, we may not be able to cooperate right off the bat, but built into the value-based enterprise are these constructs that allow us to kind of dip our toes in the water and explore and see how this works and maybe build something better so that down the road we can start to take on that reimbursement risk and really benefit from the shared savings we generate through it.
Yeah, I recall, Carrie, we had a client probably 5 years ago that was exactly their model. They wanted to go into hospitals, offer their digital health solution at a discount to other healthcare providers to improve care coordination and the handoff between sort of at discharge to SNF to home health, et cetera. And we had to tell them it was quite risky. There were no exceptions. And so this is exactly the kind of thing that these new safe harbors are enabling. One thing that is occurring to me as I'm listening is, if I had never heard about this, I would be saying, what in the world is the lift for this, right? Because a lot of these companies are familiar with what it takes to become an ACO, for instance, or a clinically integrated network, for instance, which is an enormously high bar, mm-hmm. big undertaking, big costs. It's my understanding that the creation of a VBE is a much lower bar in terms of level of effort. You know, the kinds of quality improvements can be as simple as one metric, for instance, that the companies are mm-hmm. sort of working together to tackle. Can you talk a little bit about sort of practically what it looks like to create a VBE without going too deep into the details? I know it's a complex undertaking.
Yes, absolutely. So I think that's well said. We have these existing structures like accountable care organizations and clinically integrated networks that have a lot of requirements attached to them. And explicitly acknowledged in, if you look at the kind of the federal kind of record with regard to value-based enterprises, was the government didn't want to replicate that. They didn't want to create so much red tape around these value-based enterprises so that these organizations aren't formed. So they wanted to allow for a great degree of flexibility in terms of who can participate, what sort of patients can be covered, how can payment be structured, all those sorts of things. So in terms of setting up a value-based enterprise, the lift isn't to the same extent that you see with ACOs and CINs. Now, the question is, okay, if that's the case, why haven't we seen more of these? And I think if you
exactly.
look...
That's what I'd like to get to.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think if you look at the regulatory commentary that the government solicited from folks, oftentimes over and over again, you'll see commenters say, "Hey, give us a more precise definition of, you know, what is care coordination, or tell us more explicitly, you know, what sort of patients can be covered by these value-based enterprises." And the government, again and again and again, chose not to do that. They chose to say, "We don't want to be inhibitors to innovation, so we're going to leave this kind of open-ended." The problem associated with that is one that, you know, in the economics world, you might refer to as decision fatigue, where there is so much flexibility. There are so many different things that I can do with these types of constructs that folks oftentimes don't know where to begin, where to start. And so that makes them nervous. And especially on the legal side of things, when you don't have a number of clear cases or OIG advisory opinions out there saying, "Hey, here are the guardrails that are okay for these types of entities," oftentimes there can be a desire for conservatism, or let's just not even get there. Let's wait until other folks do that. And so that's where, you know, myself and our company comes in. What we're really looking to do is help organizations set up these value-based enterprises. We've spent a lot of time within the regulations themselves looking at the different components of the definitions and requirements under the different risk models, and trying to find ways to make it simple in terms of what makes sense for an organization in regarding how they structure their value-based enterprises. So, you know, I think you guys have a great resource, and I would recommend folks check it out, and hopefully it can be linked in the description to this podcast episode. But you have a great resource kind of describing the different components of the value-based enterprise, the different definitions that go into them, things like target patient population, things like value-based activities, value-based purposes. Won't get too much in the details of that here, but I think the neat thing is that while the definitions, while there are clear and explicit definitions, there's a lot of flexibility to them. So it's a matter of kind of sitting down and finding out how to make the construct work for you. And that's where, you know, I'd like to hope that we can come in and help organizations see the potential benefit with regard to these value-based enterprises, because there is a lot of benefit there. There's a lot of flexibility there. It's just one of those things where you kind of have to dive in and take the plunge, despite the fact that other folks haven't done it. But of course, you know, going back to my background in economics, time and time again, what do we see in terms of business success? There is a big first mover advantage. Those entities that are able to figure this out early and figure it out well are going to have a big advantage over the competition.
Yeah, I mean, I agree 110%. I think that, you know, there is an element of fear and a little bit of disbelief that the government really means it when they're like, we're going to be flexible around this, right? Because no one wants to be the first to try to sort of take on, you know, that allowed flexibility and then be told, you went too far. Like, now you're in trouble, right? So, but I do think that that desire is genuine. I do think that there is, you know, a real understanding that sort of the anti-kickback statute and Stark Law constructs do not fit in a value-based world where there are reimbursable activities that we want to incentivize. And so, you know, I'm right there with you. I would urge folks to dive in, to do this carefully, but to dive in. And you're absolutely right. The first mover is going to have, I mean, they do have quite an advantage.
Yeah. And just to build on that, the government has in the Medicare innovation unit of CMS, they have all these shared savings type models. And there's nothing stopping someone from looking at that and saying, all right, what is working well here? How can we mirror that within our organization? And how can we, you know, if anyone ever questions what we're doing, say, look, we're trying to set up the same sort of things that you're doing within the CMMI program with the same sort of safe guardrails around it, and use that as kind of a starting point, because the government isn't going to complain if, say, for example, an organization set up a value-based enterprise that is sharing savings by controlling cost growth based on, let's say, historical Medicare expenditure numbers. If you're showing Medicare that, hey, you know, we can reduce expenses to you, that's not going to be, they're not going to kind of slap you on the wrist and say, shame on you for doing that. That's going to be something that they want to see. Of course, now that said, I'm not the attorney, you guys are, and there's other very important legal considerations to build within that. And would encourage folks to talk to you about those. But from a business perspective, I think, you know, taking what we've seen in the marketplace that's been done by Medicare and other payers is a good place to start to see for potential use cases for these VBEs.
Yeah, I think this is an opportunity for innovators in the digital health space outside of sort of the, you know, the traditional institutional players, hospitals, big health systems, big payers, to put together a model of what this might look like, since they, you know, they're looking for ways to set themselves apart, and they tend to have, you know, lower risk or a higher risk tolerance rather than other folks in healthcare. I mean, I think this is an opportunity for them to solve a problem on behalf of the people they're trying to sell their wares to. So I loved this discussion. Thank you so much for your time today, Luis. If folks want more of the kinds of insights they heard about today on the show, or if they're interested in talking to you about sort of the infrastructure of a VBE and how to put that together, what's the best way to get in touch?
Yeah, absolutely. I direct folks to our website. It's www.inhealthadvisors.com. And there's a nice little form there that folks can fill out if they have any questions. And I'm always happy to reach out, as is my partner, Jim. And we make it a priority to reach out to folks very quickly. So we welcome any questions or comments or even challenges to any of the things that I've had to say, and happy to start a conversation there.
I hope you enjoyed today's discussion with Luis Arguello. And of InHealth Advisors about building value-based enterprises. If you haven't already, please subscribe to Decoding Healthcare Innovation. Follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter. As always, you can check out all the links and resources in the show notes, and you can find out more about our work with healthcare innovators at nixongwiltlaw.com. I'm Rebecca Gwilt. This is Carrie Nixon.
We'll see you next time on Decoding Healthcare Innovation.
Thank you for listening to Decoding Healthcare Innovation. If you like the show, please subscribe, rate, and review at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to find out more about Carrie, me, or Nixon Gwilt Law, go to nixongwiltlaw.com or click the links in the show notes.